Chris, can you please tell me how to pronounce your name?
Krzysztof. Krzysztof Zabłocki.
I am not going to attempt to say that name. I wouldn't offend you in that way, but I'm glad that you're on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad you don't try to pronounce it again.
So people would probably know you best from the iPad app Foldify, where you can make wonderful little actual real world creatures. But I'm curious how you started off and how you got to the point where you started making iPad apps.
Oh, that's going to be a long story. I started when I was, I guess, 8 years old. My older brother, which is 7 years older than I am, so was like 15 at the time, he was messing around with Commodore 64. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yep.
But he was messing with that, and that got me interested. What is he doing all days in front of the, well, pretty small screen?
In Poland, it's called the Commodore?
Not sure how to pronounce it, to be honest. Like, this is very old device.
Just go with it in Polish.
Commodore, just Commodore. We didn't have like a Polish name for that. It's just the...
We don't have the A at the end of it. That's why, okay. I'm finding it interesting. It's just the Commodore. Yeah, it's cool.
Okay,
though.
Commodore. Maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong.
No, it's awesome.
Yeah. So basically, he was messing around with BASIC. I think it was BASIC already. And that got me interested. So I started messing around as well. I didn't do it on Commodore. I did start on Pentium or 486, the old ones. And I did start with BASIC, like QBASIC, I think that was, in DOS. When you still had to write code on proper lines, like the numbers, that was a mess. I don't know if you guys played with it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you had to leave enough, like,
yeah,
you'd number the lines space by the hundreds so that you could stick in some extra in there if you needed.
Yeah, that was crazy. Well, I didn't get my own computer until I was like 10. So 10 or 11, I don't remember exactly. I bought my first one from my brother. He always tried to squeeze money out of me. but that was how I started. So that, like, QBASIC was the first encounter with programming. And I did mess around with it. But my first actual, like, what I considered a first real code, like something that was really cool, was Pascal. When I did some first games, that was pretty cool. And that was like in primary school, like second, third grade. I remember doing a game, and the whole game was basically a bunch of if statements. So it was quite a mess. And then I grew from that. And then after Pascal, there was Delphi, which was back then still considered objective Pascal, but then they actually created a Delphi language. And I used that for quite a long time. I remember really liking it back then, but I didn't use, like, they have this visual format, like, I don't remember the exact name, but something like Windows Forms, just the old age. But I didn't use that. I actually coded just code. And I did that with DirectX graphics. So I did my own engines and frameworks. I actually wrote my own graphics, like UI kit equivalent, well, BASIC, still in primary school at the end of it. Yeah, I remember that. That was pretty cool. It's one of the first massive things I did, because that was quite, like, this was written from scratch. So it was just Objective Pascal and DirectX. No libraries, no ready-to-use components. That was, like, clean from the start. Which, basically, like, doing frameworks and engines and games, that was how I learned programming. I think it's a good way to learn, especially for young people, because, well, games are very, if you get game working, you feel very good. Like, it is a really good experience for you to see it working, to see, like, to control a character. That's pretty nice.
And yeah, then that's how I got into stuff, too. Yeah. It's a great feedback thing. It's like, all you want to do is play games. And if you've made one, it's like, oh, you feel so good.
Yeah. I think, like, the people that really want to achieve something, they need to get an easy results. Like, it doesn't matter what you do. If you get results quickly, you're going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And then that's reinforce you to do it more and more often. It's like with training. So I also train at gym. So I do like heavy with weightlifting. Mm-hmm. And I see so many people trying to get into shape and failing because they try, like they go on crash diet and they do all crazy stuff, but they never stick to it. Mm-hmm. And they never get to the point where they get results.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think games are very good because it's a quick win. Once you get something running, it's like you're enjoying it and then you get more into it and you try to mess around with it, just reinforcing the good feelings. Yeah. Did you, like, how much did you spend writing games? How long?
I made a career out of it. I did it
for, oh, really?
For like 12 to 15 years kind of thing.
Oh, that's
I mean,
cool.
I grew up writing games. It's like that's the way I learned how to program. And then tried to dodge getting into programming.
What did you use for game programming?
Pascal.
Okay.
A lot of Pascal and a lot of 386 assembler.
Okay.
Eventually getting into C and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I did exactly what you're describing, which is learn to program through a very quick and effective feedback loop, mm-hmm. which is making games. Yeah.
So how did you enjoy switching from Pascal to C?
I didn't find it that weird.
Well, I did find it weird at the start. Like it was a bit different.
At the start, yeah. But I mean, so the Turbo Pascal I was using was, I mean, they had the idea of pointers. They had the idea of reference. I was writing a lot of inline assembly. So, you know, the lower level stuff wasn't that weird. I found C a little bit Spartan. Like, you know, Pascal's got begin and end and C's got the, you know, the crazy brackets.
Yeah.
So I found it a little bit, I don't know.
I hope you didn't try to define begin end.
No. I'm not an idiot.
Some people did. Like
I know. I've seen that. It's crazy. I've worked in code bases that have had that done, and it's just, that's too much. But you're interviewing me, so you're taking my job here, man.
Well,
how did you find it? Like, what was your transition?
Well, I didn't have big problem moving from one to another because with Delphi, I didn't really use the visual tools. So I was already doing just code, so it was just a matter of new syntax. But for quite some time, I was protective of Objective Pascal. Like, I really liked it, and I was arguing with friends, like, you can do the same things with C++ and Objective Pascal. We have these flame wars going on. But then I switched, and I never looked back. Like,
well, I'm kind of curious. Why were they arguing about that? It's perfectly fine language.
Well, it's a flame war, right? DirectX versus OpenGL. It just that's how we start. Like, currently, if you ask, do you use Interface Builder? And then you have two camps. Some people hate it, some people enjoy it. It's not a question you should ask with Cocoa developers. It's just crazy. I personally, I don't know if you guys like follow me on, like, you have me on Twitter, but I am all ahead of using tools right now. I used to do code layout for 2 years. I didn't touch Interface Builder at all, but then I forced myself to really try it. And I just recently, a month ago or so, I published a tutorial how to make a game, and I use Interface Builder for level editor, and the whole game, like, was a very simple game, but still under 250 lines of code, just because I could use that.
Yeah, Interface Builder is great. It's great. The auto layout inside Interface Builder, not so great.
Yeah, I'm trying that now.
Yeah, it's Interface crazy. Builder itself is a massive win. It's a great way of writing software.
Yeah, it is. But, it is saving a lot of time. It saved me tons of time.
It's crazy. But Delphi had something similar. It had the visual builder thing.
Yeah,
I used Delphi a little bit in my career during games, the amount of little tools that you build for yourselves is nuts. And one of them I built using, or a couple I built using Delphi, and I liked it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that builder thing was pretty interesting.
Yeah, what was the name? I don't remember the
no idea.
I remember that, yeah, but I never used it, like, because I was doing games, I tried to avoid it. Like, I used it a few times, but I never used it for an engine or a framework. When I switched to C++, I didn't use MFC or Windows Forms. I just used, when I wanted to do UI, I did VX widgets. I don't mm-hmm. know if you guys use that.
Yep.
But you saw the screenshots from my game engine, right? The one mm-hmm. I wrote C++. So yeah, I wrote the whole editor using VX widgets. It was pretty good.
Yeah,
I heard very good things about what's the name? It's the cross-platform, the other one. So there is VX widget for UI, but there is also this one that offers signals and like sockets.
Oh, Qt Kit?
Yeah, Qt. Yeah. I heard good things about it from friends. I never had a chance to use it. Did you guys use it?
I haven't used it, no.
Okay.
I mean, when it was getting popular, I was already on the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but it has a Mac version, right?
Yeah, but the Mac has AppKit. So
yeah.
I'd way rather use AppKit and Objective-C than some weird... I really don't like C++.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
I think going on record, I'm going to get a lot of hate mail, but well, maybe not. But it drives me nuts. I cannot stand it.
When was last time you actually used it for a commercial product?
Oh, like 40 years ago? Like a long time ago. And I do believe it's growing and everything, and it's matured. The things you can do with it kind of horrify me. I think it's too big. There's too many quirks that can be used. I think you can use it well, but I think it offers enough rope to hang yourself on.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, the stuff I did for my game engine, right? So I wanted a 3D game engine, and I wanted it to be flexible and all. Well, that's what you do. That's what you do when you want to create a framework, or a real engine. So basically, in C++, I created my own type management and factoring and serialization. Basically, you could add a new class. So mm-hmm. let's give you an example. So the whole editor, which you already saw, this is what's the name? What you see is what you get, right? That was the whole point.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole editor had under 2,000 lines of code, and it had generating shaders from graphs. It had physics, Lua scripting, and all other mess like property grid and get generation from objects. And the really cool thing, which I'm still proud of, is if you wanted to add a new object to editor, well, you didn't really need to, because if you added a new class to engine, so you could just create a new C++ class,
mm-hmm.
and you just use two macros, which was like declare class and implement class, which was very like single line macro. Mm-hmm. You just call that, you run the editor, and you have a new object to create and modify, and you get all the properties and all the stuff you want, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, so now, I built up my own reflection, basically. The stuff you get with Objective-C, for example, for free, more or less. So I did that on top of C++.
That's what I was going to say, is that, yeah, that is very cool that you did it with C++, but you had to re-implement a bunch of stuff, or you had to make it make sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know Objective-C back then, so I didn't know there is something already like that.
Honestly, I'd probably go with C++ for a game engine anyway. There's way too much crazy stuff in there.
Well, if you think about it, like in most commercial apps, what do you think? That's the question I wanted to ask you. What do you think is harder, making a game or making an application? Let's get like the average run-of-the-mill game and the average iOS app, for example, or a Mac app. Which do you want? Which one would be harder, in your opinion?
I don't know if that's a fair question because I've done both. I expect people would think that making a game is harder.
Mm-hmm.
But I think making a really good app is harder. Not that the code is harder to write, but mm-hmm. Just, you know, refining it to the point that it's like a triple A application is difficult. It's, mm-hmm. it takes a lot of thought and a lot of work. So I don't know which is easier or which is harder, but they're very different processes for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely different. Well, I think like good thing about games and using it when you start programming is there is just so many disciplines that you need to learn, like math, physics, artificial intelligence, and all the other stuff, which doesn't really happen in apps. Like, I agree, like, to really have a best-selling app, you have to put a lot of attention to detail. But isn't that true for games as well? I think it is.
It is. Yeah.
Well, I think it's like, it really depends, right? Obviously, it depends on the tools you have. So if you use like Unity, it's obviously going to give you...
Yeah, you skip a bunch of like the disciplines. But I mean, you know, taking the question from the base of it, yeah, you need so many disciplines when you're writing a game. So many.
See.
On the other hand, you can have some rough edges that people just kind of overlook, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Gameplay doesn't need to be perfect. Like, the core gameplay has to be very good.
But you can have like some boring ass levels and like people just, whatever. Yeah. They'll get
as long as you keep the pace correctly, then it's going to work.
Right.
Yeah. I agree.
it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it like that before.
I always like people when I interview people, I like when people have game background, like game dev background, because what I found is not just game dev, but like C languages.
Mm-hmm.
Not this high level languages like just C# or othernet or Java.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people that did games or did C++ programming, they had to think about algorithms, like actually come up with solutions for big problems, which is very good, because I'd rather hire an engineer that doesn't know specific API. Like, I don't really care for a permanent role. I don't really care if they know this framework or this. Yeah. If they are good, they can learn. So it's not a matter of like having the documentation in your head. Mm-hmm. But I had many people with like years of experience with Net and C#, and they didn't know how to solve problems, which was pretty scary.
Yeah, that's hiring people is tricky.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is very tricky, especially like I am only 24 still.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interviewing people that have 15 years of commercial experience, and that's just scary, right?
That's a different, you know.
It moves fast.
It's not that, yeah, exactly. It's not that their skills aren't there. It's just that they're not a good fit necessarily for you. I think when you've done sort of C-level languages, you kind of actually understand how the machine works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
it's a bit different, right? It's core.
Yeah. What are you interviewing for?
Well, I'm working at the app business in London, and I do interviews for, mostly iOS guys right now.
So and is it hard to find somebody that suits the criteria?
Yeah, it is hard to find good senior positions. Like, there are a lot of people I interview. Some of them are good, but like a senior level, not that easy. It is quite complicated to find someone like that. So, for example, I have a bunch of questions for people, and I don't think anyone answered all of them yet. And I interviewed like over 30 people. Easily. Mm. Yeah. Maybe I've heard from,
I've heard from people that it's difficult to get like sort of senior level hire is done.
Yeah, it's all okay.
Doesn't matter who you are. Like, even Apple has problems mm-hmm. with it. So,
yeah, I heard, like, I'm not sure if it's true, but I heard, like, for Apple, it's like 1,000 people apply, 2 people get in. I'm not sure if that's true. That's what I heard from one of the ex-evangelists.
Yeah.
Which is pretty scary. Like, well, on the other hand, I guess a lot of people apply to Apple. It's such a good company.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Right? Yeah, they need to filter everything. What's your favorite interview question?
My favorite interview question.
Yeah. Watch me get it wrong. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I ask a lot of questions, but I also, like, I have 3 categories of questions. Mm-hmm. So I ask general IT, like, what is HashMap? How is it built, for mm-hmm. example? Which very few people will really know. It's kind of scary. And then I ask iOS. Yeah. Yeah. I ask, like, about internals. So, how does it work? More or less, I don't expect them to implement it on a table sure. or on a paper.
Right.
I just want to know, like, they understand the concept. Well, actually, like, the easiest question I ask, which is general IT, which is, what's the difference between a linked list and a vector or an array, depending on language? You would be surprised how few people actually know the difference. It's just scary. People come up with...
That's weird. That's like CompSci 101 kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, this is a very easy question. And people like come up with sorting and stuff like that. I didn't even ask for that. Like, I'm just asking about the data structure. It's scary. But I ask the basic questions. Yeah. Then I ask some iOS specific ones and also stuff that let me know how people think. So I ask, for example, so you have a table view, which has cells. Each cell has an image which is loaded from network, and I just want to see how people would, like, what do they think about, how do they mm-hmm. make the performance smooth. So they have to know that you should cancel downloading, you just cannot keep starting new downloads, right? Because then you're gonna, if you have like hundreds of cells, you're just gonna keep adding mm-hmm. New downloads, which means the images you're looking currently at, they would download the last. So mm-hmm. they have to use some kind of either canceling or priority queues, stuff like that. It's quite basic, but yeah. there are few
quirks. No, but that's a good problem solving question, yeah. right? Like, that's something that happens.
Yeah.
Like, that's
yeah.
a real problem that actually comes up, but probably. You know, most iOS apps.
Yeah, well, I ask, all of the questions I ask are real life problems. Mm-hmm. Most people would probably get most of the things right if they read my blog. But they don't bother, so, well, that's what happened. They don't answer, and then, well, what can I say? Like, I can live with people not knowing some specific thing, because the problem with programming is if you don't encounter a problem, like yeah. the advanced stuff. If you don't encounter that, how would you know it, right?
Right.
It's kind of hard. It's based on experience. So I'd rather have someone, like I said, I'd rather have someone that is smart, and I can see that even if they don't know the answer, they still can think about it and find a way to work around it and right. just see how they think, if they just give up or if they are really eager to solve it. This is a big difference for me.
Yeah. Like, you know, I just cracked a joke about the linked list thing, but I can't remember the last time I actually wrote a linked list for myself.
Yeah, you don't do that, right?
Yeah, it used
to be like in games and stuff like that.
Oh my God, I used to be doing like 5 linked lists a day kind of thing, but no, now I don't. So yeah, that's a good point. Is that okay? So maybe they don't know the difference between a linked list and an array, but if they have the wherewithal and the intelligence to realize that there is a difference,
yeah.
that's, you know, a good sign.
Well, yeah, I don't really try to, like, I don't believe in solving problems at the interview, because people, like, right. some people are stressed, like really stressed,
yeah,
and then they might do bad, but they are really good. It's just stress. Because it's a bit different situation, right? Most good people don't really proactively look for job change. Yep. Because they're usually happy where they are. And if they go to interview, it's because someone reached out to them. So it is a bit different. Me, for example, when I was interviewing for a business, I didn't really have a proper CV. Wasn't mm-hmm. really looking for a job change. I just had a recruiter call me, and he was very eager and very like proactive. And I was like, what the hell? I'll go to London for 2 days. And I really enjoyed the guys I met at the app business. So mm-hmm. I decided, let's give it a try. Let's move to London.
Yeah, it's different when you're, I guess, established is the word. I can't remember the last time I had an actual interview.
Yeah, this is a big problem because many people will ask you some questions like solve problem, which is like university problem or a contest. Right. Like yeah. It's not really a real programming. It's more math. And yeah. You get rusty. And then it's a problem, right? You go for an interview and you're like, I'm a really good programmer, but I don't remember that.
Right.
It's kind of scary. That's why people do like programming kata and stuff like that, like exercises.
Right. Yeah, I've definitely had that where somebody asks me like a basic programming thing and I'm like, I just draw a blank because it's been it's been like 20 years since I had to think about it. And I'm like, I don't know. I just do it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like math. Like, how do you do long division? I don't know. Like, I type the numbers in the computer and it works out. Like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
So you've done like a lot of graphics projects.
Yeah, quite a lot.
Yeah. Is there a reason for that or you just find it fun?
Well, the reason was games, right? This is how I got into it, and that's really my passion. I really loved it. Until I moved to mobile, I just did games, like games, oh, really? Entertainment. Yeah, mostly. Yeah. I didn't do it commercially. I did it for fun because I liked the challenge. So it was interesting to push myself to do better and better frameworks. And
yeah. Honestly, you probably had a better time. Commercial games are it's a business.
Yeah, you know? I heard bad things about it.
I mean, there's good and bad, but it's, you know, it's a business. And,
sure.
I'm sure what you were doing was a lot more fun.
Well, I wouldn't, like, from what I heard from friends, I would never go to work for a game dev company.
Yeah.
Not in a lifetime. Just it feels really like the stuff that people were saying about Zynga on all different sites was scary how they treat people. It's really
I actually do think Zynga was an extreme, but
it is quite like a lot of overtime, right?
Oh yeah,
that's what happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a bunch of young boys, basically for the most part, excited to be making games that will work their asses off, and the company is a company, and so it will leverage that and just, you know, let them run themselves into the ground.
Yeah. But the thing is, people will burn out. Like, they will lose.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, here's the thing. Here's the basically a bunch of young people. And I said boys earlier, it's not just boys, but it's mostly boys. Get into the business. They get all excited about working on whatever it is, like the next game where you run around shooting people.
Yeah.
They run themselves into the ground. And then they end up getting out of the industry. And so that experience and the intelligence leaves and it doesn't end up in the management chain. You know what I mean? Like like the people who are sane are like, screw this, I'm out.
Yeah.
And so they don't become managers, and the managers don't make the right decisions because it's not being informed by experience as much, and it's a vicious cycle. It just keeps going and going and going, and it's awful. And it's not always like that. And people aren't managers. Honestly, do not want to burn people out. It's not like a total cynical thing, but it's a systemic problem where, you know, people just run themselves into the ground. The entire industry just runs itself into the ground tirelessly for decades on end.
Yeah.
It's,
that sounds right. Yeah. That's pretty much what happens with most publishers. Like if you read the stories about like the guys that created Lanor, the crime solving game, they also had a lot of issues with how they managed employees. And it's just scary because there are really good games out there, like really good studios. I really enjoy gaming. Like I have PS3 and I keep playing, probably way too much. But there are really good games, like the new BioShock.
Really I haven't tried that yet. Is that as good as everybody says it is?
I loved it. I played, like, it took me 2 or 3 days to finish it from start. Oh. I just couldn't stop playing. But yeah, if you look at the games, they're really good quality. It's just sad to hear the stories about people being mistreated and just really sad. A lot of talent. A lot of talent there.
And it's not on purpose. You know what I mean? It's just the way things, I don't know, it's
lack of the experience in the managers, right?
That's what I think so. It's like nobody sets out to be a jerk.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the culture of the game development business is one in which people just get mauled pretty much, you know?
Well, it's also like it is a bit the fault of the people, of the actual programmers. Because if you don't set boundaries, mm-hmm. like about the quality of your work, and like you cannot really expect, like as a professional, you cannot really expect to be able to work 12 hours every day for 2 weeks and keep the quality. Like that's not really going to happen, right? You should know that.
Right.
After a few years, you
know, there was people that were going home. There's a culture going on too, which is a bit weird. There's like an overtime culture. So there were people that were going home or going to pick up their, you know, their children. Yeah. And other, like their teammates would be like, oh man, I can't believe he's leaving early.
Yeah,
Talking about? Like, guy's picking up his kids. Crazy. Like, yeah. It's a bizarre little culture.
Yeah, but that's not only in games, right?
No,
it's just a matter of setting boundaries correctly. But I agree, like some other people from the team might think so, but that's usually because they are not professional enough.
Yeah,
there are just some rules you shouldn't break.
Right. Games have a younger... I mean, these people are in their early 20s for the most part, I believe. So that kind of skews a bit of the perception sort of thing, you know?
Yeah,
like
yeah,
it's their first... It's their first career job almost, or they're definitely early in their career. They're excited about the project that they're working on. And so if you're not as committed to it as they feel that you should be, you know, there's a little bit of weird cult thing going on, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I kind of imagine, like, lacking the experience of working under a lot of stress, and then if they go into, because what happens, they usually rotate teams quite a lot, right? Because people burn out very quickly.
Yep.
So they go into a project and they didn't have the same conditions before, and they think it's gonna be just temporary, for example. So they think like maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month. But what usually happens is the deadlines move. So first they work to a deadline, which is like a month ahead. So they work overtime just to keep that deadline. And what usually happens, it's not in games, but it's like usual, they move the deadline and the people just work their asses off, and now they have to work for another deadline and they add features, and that's what happens, right? And you have, like, people have to be careful about it, like not just game dev, but in general. This is also, like, I was reading Clean Coder like a few weeks ago, and there was a story about this guy that, like, had a project for 2 weeks or so. So he went into a project which was just supposed to be this and this, very simple, and even though he had experience like that before, and he knew it's never gonna be that easy. He still went into it, and then they keep adding stuff, and they had the deadline, and he worked like crazy overtime, bad code, and everything.
Yeah.
And what happened? They didn't even release it, which is like, it's a massive drain for a programmer. So we are creative beings. We want, first of all, what I enjoy is having my app in hands of people, not really putting it into a closet. That might have worked when I was younger, but right now I just hate programming stuff that doesn't end up with actual products. It just feels like a waste.
So why is that? Just because I don't get the sense that it's an ego thing. It's not that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that I think you want people to be like, oh yeah, he made this. Is it like you don't want to feel like you're wasting your effort? Is that it?
Well, I think it's a validation, right? So if I do, like, let's say I write a framework, and that might work for me. But if it doesn't end up, I might think it works. Maybe that. I might think it's a good way to do it. But if I don't have it in a real product or I don't open source it, I'm never going to be sure, right? So I write something, I waste 2 months or something, and I don't really get the validation if my, like, a design or an architecture was correct. So it's kind of like motivation. Mm-hmm. I like to know, like, I open source a lot of stuff right now. I didn't used to do, like, 2 years ago, I didn't have anything open source. Right now, I have like 10 or whatever number of repositories on GitHub.
So why is that? It's like a check my work kind of thing? Like you want other smart people to be able to look at it and give you feedback. Is that it?
That's one thing, but I also want to give back to the community. Why not? I mean, I use a lot of open source libraries, and people are doing great job, especially like Cocoa community is very good. We have very good people working and sharing stuff, which I really like. I really use a lot, and I just wanted to share some of my creations just so people can save time like I did. So it's just a matter of being a good member of the community, right?
That's nice. Yeah. You know what? We do have a very sort of, I can't think of anybody in the sort of the Apple Cocoa community that won't just tell you exactly how they did something.
Yeah, it is quite nice. Like NS Conference was very nice. We met a lot of good people there, and I really enjoyed it. I'm definitely going to the next one.
Great. Yeah, Scotty's awesome. Love that guy.
Yeah. Great conference. I finally met some of the people that I followed for years, like Nick Lockwood,
maker
of the iCarousel, which almost everyone used back in the day. He's not that popular on Twitter, but he's getting there.
Twitter doesn't make sense. It's no gauge of anything. Did you have a favorite talk?
My favorite talk on the NS conference, probably Flipboard one. Did you watch it?
No, I haven't seen it. What was the gist?
It was about the tools, like, and the development setup they have at Flipboard, which is very nice. It's impressive. And I actually, a day after the conference, I released, because they mentioned overlaying like the Git commit version and the app version on top of the icon dynamically. So a day after the conference, I shared that. I just wrote it the next day and open sourced it.
I totally set you up for that, because I'm looking at that page on your blog right now, and I just, I guessed, took a stab that would be your favorite talk. Yeah, that's a pretty cool thing. Everybody should check that out. We'll try to put the link on the notes. So back to graphics. What's your experience with 3D like?
With 3D, you mean?
Yeah. So you were non-professionally working on a lot of games for yourself.
Mostly engines.
Yeah. Mostly like 3D engines or what?
Yeah. So mostly graphics. Not really, like, I did games when I started. And then I moved into more and more into technology. So I did a frameworks, and then like I actually had like two UIKit equivalent libraries back in the day, and then I moved
into on the Mac, right?
That was still like C++ and DirectX, so still Windows. And then I created a few, like I created a few games, but then I moved into a 3D graphics, which was mostly game engines instead of games.
With Direct3D underneath or OpenGL?
DirectX, still DirectX. Yeah, I was doing Windows back in the time. Before I switched to iOS, I was a heavy Windows user.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
And I really enjoyed working on 3D graphics. I mean, the problem with games is you need a lot of assets.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, that's why I did engines, because I could work on algorithms and I could work on optimization and basically learning a lot on the way. Yeah. Without really needing a real asset, so I.
Yeah, I mean, the secret of games is that I think you know you hear about the programmers, but they're less than a third of the team.
Yeah,
they're a tiny number of people compared to like the level designers and the 3D artists and the texture artists and the you know, it goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Sound design is huge. You can't just sit down and make yourself a game these days. Well,
yeah, that's the problem.
You can, but you're not like a 3D game, you know?
Yeah, it's easier to do 2D games.
Yeah.
But like indie games.
Yeah.
With 3D is always a problem, unless you come up with some clever artistic graphics, which is like black and white lines or whatever.
Yeah.
Then you can work with that. But most,
you're still stuck with the level design problem.
Yeah.
Sound design.
How do you test how do you test 3D game engine, right?
Yeah.
How do you test that? Because a real test has to have real assets, like actual game level design and stuff like that. So I'm not sure if I should mention that, but what I did, so I had my own 3D game engine, right? Already written. And then Fallout 3 came out.
Cool.
And it has very nice levels. And I wrote a Reaper for the whole game, and I extracted all of the Fallout 3 levels from it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was crazy. Like I had the metro stations, which were huge levels. And when I first launched it with my game engine, which was tested before, and with my own levels, which was very simple, obviously, because I didn't have time to work on them. So when I first launched, it was like 5 frames per second.
Ouch.
So it was really good. It was a really good benchmark to start working on it. And I ended up with like 70 frames.
Nice.
This is how you should test a real game engine.
Yeah.
Put it like
real life.
Put it. Yeah.
Real life data. Exactly. So wait, you went from 5 to 70 frames a second?
Yeah. I even had to, like, I even optimized the memory allocator. So I had my custom one.
Oh, God. Yeah. I've done that. That seems like the stupidest thing to have to optimize, but it pays off quite a bit.
Yeah, it does. Especially with the architecture I had was like,
Like a bunch of small allocations.
Yeah. Exactly.
That'll do it. What'd you do? You just ended up with an array that you handed out?
Pre-allocated
a bunch of stuff and then just...
Yeah, I did pagination and pools, like memory pools. So I reused memory and I used new in place. Like, what was the name of C++ new allocator? You just specify the memory it should like reinitialize the object in. So I used that and I used...
Wait, seriously? That's part of the language?
Yeah, you can... That's horrible. You have new, which is just allocating a new object in memory, and you have new placement, which is you just specify a memory pointer, and it's going to basically execute constructor on that memory. So it's basically reusing memory, no allocation needed. Obviously, that's kind of risky if you don't design for it, because you can end up with some messed up pointers.
Yeah, but I forgot you could do that. See, C++ is insane.
Well, you could reinitialize memory.
No, like I realize like why you'd want that, and yes, but come on, that's just crazy. The amount of things you can do with C++ is just mind-boggling, you know?
Well, you can do most of the stuff with Objective-C. Most people just don't know it.
Like, yeah, that's it. But that's like you're talking about a feature built into the language.
Yeah. Well, come on. I cannot create dynamic subclasses in C++. I can do that with Objective-C. Yeah. I actually do that in Objective-C with some of my open source stuff. So, for example, do you guys know Cocos2D?
You know what? I've never shipped anything with it, but I've looked into it a lot. Yeah.
So it's still using this old touch recognition. So it uses touches begun, touches ended, which, as you can imagine, is kind of hard if you want to do a gesture-driven app, because you have to recognize all the gestures yourselves. And then you have the standard UI gesture recognizers, which are very specific to iOS. Mm-hmm. So if you even if you write your own gesture recognition on touches begun ended, you're still gonna like the user's gonna notice it, because there is no way you're gonna get the same experience, because it's a bunch of params and all the other behavior. It's just too specific. So Cocos doesn't have support for a category on top of it, which basically adds that. So we just include a header, and it automatically adds support for UI gesture recognizers without any wrappers. You just can add it to any Cocos object. And this is done in some clever ways, like dynamic subclassing in code.
You know what? I'd seen that post, but I hadn't looked into how you did it.
Mm-hmm.
So do you do? You dynamically subclass, like...
So first I tried swizzling. So when I add some methods, which are easy, the easy part. So I add for each CC node, which is like the basic of the scene. I add gesture recognizer, remove gesture recognizer. I obviously also add automatic removal if the object dies, because the gesture recognizer will be added to window, like to view.
Instead of, you have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Right.
So you have to clean it up. So I actually use associated objects to clean it up when the object dies, which is a nice and clever way of doing it, because it doesn't require manual removal, which I hate.
Yeah, that was a great addition to the framework to the runtime. That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah, they added it like in 3.0, I think.
Ah, you're talking iOS style. I don't know.
A few years ago.
Yeah,
it is quite old. Some people still don't know it, though. Kind of scary.
Yeah.
That's the easy part. But what I do when you add a gesture recognizer, I used to swizzle, so I can have a separate delegate, because there is a bit different logic behind finding the proper node to use with the gesture recognizer.
Yeah. Did you swizzle the method?
Yeah, I swizzled.
Not the isser, the class pointer? Okay.
Back then I didn't. I'm getting So I didn't just swizzle on the actual gesture recognizer class.
Okay.
But after some time, I had some crashes, and I looked into it. And it seems that when you use UI WebView or popover controller, Apple swizzles something. They do something with the gesture recognizers.
Really?
Dynamically, yes. And that messes up with your custom swizzles, which is a problem.
Man.
Yeah, so instead
of... I'm going to talk to somebody about that, because that's funny.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I'm going to make fun of somebody.
Issue, which I was pretty stressed about when I was working with Foldify. I was like crashing for some weird reason.
Weird.
The custom swizzle had a very simple function. It was just, if there is an associated object for a custom delegate, use that instead of the original one. If not, just use the original one, which means the code was very simple. There was no way.
Yeah, it's one if statement in your... Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was just a simple if statement. And that was crashing, because you used UI WebView or popover. I don't remember which one. But one of these, when you use them, they did something to the gesture recognizers, which meant my code interfered with their changes. And just...
So just weird.
Yeah, so what I ended up doing is I dynamically subclass the gesture recognizer class, change the ISA pointer.
Yeah.
And then when you remove it, I just return to the original class. So if you remove a gesture recognizer from my CC node, just works the way it used to. Very nice, very clean and safe. First of all, no crashes from that point on. So that's my go-to tool right now. I'd rather do that than Swizzling.
Just stomp the user pointer of a class. That's awesome.
Well, I did the same thing they do with Key-Value Observer, right?
Yeah.
It behaved like the same class. So if you use the Objective-C...
It just all works. We lost some listeners. The ISA pointer is the pointer. It's the very first sort of integer-sized segment of your class structure of an instance, and it points to the Objective-C runtime class definition. Effectively, I don't know how to describe it better than that. So if you change that, the instance that you're looking at can behave as any other kind of class at all. The data that is also in the structure will be reinterpreted as if it was a class of whatever the ISA pointer is pointing to. Is that a good way of describing that?
Well, it's basically it's faking the
type. It's the identity, of the object, right? The type, right?
It's just changing, like, dynamically saying that's not really a table, that's a chair, basically.
Yes, yeah. Basically, it's the type. So with KVO, key value observing, when you start observing something, the frameworks create a class, a special class, that handles the notifying you when changes are made. And it changes the ISA pointer, it changes the actual type to point to this specific new type of class that does the notifying. So you did something similar, basically. You sort of pulled the rug out from under the
I did. So all the frameworks, all the stuff that interacted with the gesture recognizers that didn't notice any change.
Yeah, because it's a subclass, right? You dynamically subclass.
So it did treat it the same, but it just behaved differently. It's just a safer way to do overrides.
Well, it's safer when you know what you're doing.
Yeah, obviously, like, playing with runtime can be dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. So did you use this in Foldify?
Yes, I definitely do. Like, okay, if you look at Foldify, it has a lot of gestures.
So why don't you describe Foldify to everybody?
Well, Foldify. What can I say? It's a quite new app which allows you to create papercraft, which is 3D paper figures.
Mm-hmm.
So Foldify lets you design them at the same time, watch them being folded, like the actual product. So on the one side of the screen, you see unfolded paper. You draw on that. And at the same time, you see the folded one on the left. You can interact with both sides.
So yeah, and on the left-hand side, it's a full-on 3D view that you can sort of rotate around and check it out.
So it's basically previewing the figure after you print it and fold it from actual paper.
It's such a great idea. It's so charming. I love this idea. Where did it come from? Like, what made you want to build this app?
Well, we were thinking about the next product. And the ideas we had was something that would connect digital and real world. So we were thinking maybe cutouts, like 2D cutouts, like the kids used to play like years ago, just print something, cut it out, and then do figures.
Mm-hmm.
But it just sounded so easy from technical point. And I like if I do something after work, which means I instead of spending time with friends or doing anything else, I have to sit in front of the computer. You never know, like with Apple, you never know if you're going to have a hit or a miss because the market is so big. So there are so many good apps that no one noticed. And I just wanted something that would be good for the portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it doesn't sell very well, I still have something.
You can point to and like, be proud of. Yeah,
exactly. So I was like, 2D. That's not really impressive. I already had a drawing app. Let's think about 3D. And then I did some research and I found Papercraft and CubeCraft. Mm-hmm. And that looked really nice. But I wasn't sure if that's going to be feasible because we were targeting iPad 1 still. Mm. So I wasn't sure. It actually, the whole app works on iPad 1. We just disabled it for the App Store because it's just not worth the support. This is obviously going to be slower and it's worse user experience.
Right.
But yeah, the whole app pretty much works on iPad 1. And I had to prove it. So the first thing I did was very simple prototype, which would just have on the right side a paper, on the left side a 3D model with the preview, and just being able to draw a single line very easily, very rough. And that worked, so we knew it's possible to do it. It wasn't that easy to get to the final product, but it was definitely possible, as we proven.
So what was the what was the biggest complication, or the biggest hurdle that you had to leap over?
Well, there were quite a few things to figure out. So, for example, I really liked Paper by 53.
Yep.
Which had this really nice drawing. And I really wanted to have similar tool in Foldify. Mm-hmm. So I actually worked like a week or 2 weeks on the algorithm for that, because they didn't post anything, any blog or any source code.
Yeah, and this is how you got the
tutorial
smooth drawing with Cocos 2D, right?
Yeah. So I first researched what's already there, and I couldn't find a single solution that would go from scratch to actual proper line drawing with anti-aliasing and a really nice quality. So I decided to do it myself and open source it. So I actually did that. I created the whole algorithm for that. It took me quite a long time because everyone was saying to use, like, I think it was a CatMullRom algorithm.
Yeah.
Which is like this a bit more complicated Bezier drawing.
Yeah.
But that didn't turn out the way I wanted, because it is a nice algorithm to use, but you already have to have a set of points, like big set of points, because it's not interactive algorithm.
Right. Yeah, so I did something similar which is, I think I talked about this already on the show, which is why I think you got in touch with me originally. But yeah, I ended up, I looked at that approach, the CatMullRom smoothing stuff. And it is cool, but you can't really use it interactively.
Yeah, that's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Everyone was suggesting use CatMullRom, and I tried using it and just didn't give me lines that looked good. Like,
it
did smooth some of the bits, but just still was pretty rough. So at the end, I was almost giving up. But I'm really I don't like giving up. So I already implemented it with CatMullRom, and I already had the anti-aliasing. So I come up with the idea that it's just a matter of blending the color to get the smooth lines instead of jagged ones. Because really what you see when you have a drawing, you see the corners, like the edges of the line, because there is a massive difference between one color and the other.
Right.
So my idea was, what happens if I blend the color? So if I go from full color of the line to full blended line, which is like transparency, like 100% transparent. And I tried that, and that actually works very well. So it's like almost, if you don't zoom in, like in Foldify, obviously you can zoom in, so it's a bit complicated. But if you don't zoom in, it looks like a perfect line. So you don't have any edges, which is very nice. And it's very low cost, because it's not hardware anti-aliasing, which would mean we would have to add that to every geometry we draw, which is models, icons, all other stuff, which we didn't need. So this is like very specific, very easy to implement, very on iPad 1 without a problem. But yeah, the hardest thing, I think, was not giving up when I was working on the algorithm. So I had already working the anti-aliasing and the basic smoothing of the lines, but then I didn't really like the effect. So what I did, I just draw it out and I just tried a simple Bezier and that worked very well. Mm-hmm. So I ended up just doing quad Beziers, which are the simplest ones, and just using midpoints between like when the gesture recognizer would catch points, I would just use mid between the two as the control point. It just worked.
That's what I love about graphics programming is that you get to cheat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, does it look good? Okay, that's fine. You won. Like, you don't.
Yeah.
You
know, it's not math. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's math to it, but.
Yeah. It's about the visual results, not the actual representation.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what you're doing behind the scenes, so long as it looks right when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the problem really interesting because there's the quote unquote sort of correct thing to do, mm-hmm. which may well be the Catmull ROM approach. And then there's the thing that actually works right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, whatever you manage to hack together, you know. And yeah. I love that. I love the sort of the freedom of just being able to sort of come up with an interesting way to address issues.
Yeah, I mean, that's really nice about gaming, right? So you don't really want realistic graphics. You want a graphics that looks cool. That's the end result. You don't want physics that behaves exactly like real life. You want the one that will allow you to break everything and make everything fly over, right? That's how games work.
Yeah, it's a simulation of an absurd world.
Yeah.
Where you get to define whatever you want to be the, you know, to be reality.
Yeah, that's what I always loved about game dev. It's just programming in general. It's like how you define things behave, it's up to you. It's up to your imagination. You are not limited by actual world, like actual things, because it's all in the code, so you can control everything. If you want to change how gravity works, go ahead. Just do it.
Right.
That's like the coolest thing you can think about when programming, having the control over the whole thing.
I love that. That is just actually inspirational. It feels like we should just end the interview right there. What are your plans, man? What are you working on now?
Working on Foldify for iPhone.
Nice.
Yeah.
How did it do? I love it. It should.
Mm-hmm.
If people haven't bought that and they're listening to this, just go out right now. We'll go out.
Get it now.
Yeah, go get it now. It's great. Yeah.
Well, it's doing really good. Like the Foldify, so the Apple has this new category in mm-hmm. US, which is 10 apps that wow.
Nice. Okay.
Which is like the essentials. So it's back on the main page right now, and we are in. Like there are only 10 apps there.
Cool.
And each of the app has the description from Apple itself, which is not ours. Like they didn't ask us. They just gave a description for Foldify, and it's there. It's among 10 apps that, wow, Apple for that's. But for me personally, that's more impressive than editor choice.
Yep. Oh, definitely.
Because they choose like it's like 300,000 apps for.
Hey, I got an editor choice. You don't need to knock it.
It's just huge for me because, like, I feel really honored.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what are you working on for Foldify? You're doing it for the iPhone, and you got any future expansion ideas?
Well, we have quite a lot of content to add to the existing one. So we added the color book mode, which was kind of Rana's idea.
It was Liana's idea. I just passed it along. Yeah.
So we added that, but we added just a few templates. So we have like 20 or more templates coming soon, which we will be adding as an update to the iPad version. Mm-hmm. And I'm working a bit on the iPhone one, which will be a bit different UI, but
yeah,
it's the same.
I'm curious to see what that'll end up looking like.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about the creation part of it. So the designer already come up with some ideas, but I think we need to refine it a bit because it's a bit harder on iPhone because it's a smaller screen.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But I think the concept of zooming in and zooming out instead of controlling the brush size, that's going to work pretty well on iPhone.
Yeah, I think that's I don't know who came up with that first. I know my partner Chris Parrish did it at one point for a touch-up where, like, yeah, rather than adjusting the size of the brush, you basically zoom in on the painting, and it's always the size of your finger.
Yeah, I don't remember if I was, like, I probably just did it because I didn't like brush control.
Felt
like unnecessary UI.
Yeah, no, I think it's, not to say it's obvious, but I think when you start writing, you know, when you start working on something like that,
It feels natural.
Right? Exactly. It feels natural. And I think it's an interesting little leap from where we used to be, where you would literally just adjust the brush size with a slider, you know?
Yeah. It feels like, from my point of view, it's like, I'm not a designer. Uh-huh. I cannot really draw. Like, I do not draw. I just use existing tools. but what I found is my designers used SensuBrush.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it doesn't really matter because if they change the brush size, it's still visible because it's not finger. It's very small.
Mm-hmm.
So they can get used to it. But if you try drawing with your finger, it just feels like if I decrease the size of the brush, I'm just going to lose the control over the details. Yeah. Because then I have to go back in time, redo, undo, and it just doesn't make sense. So instead, just zoom in, draw the details correctly, zoom out, draw the big stuff. It's quite easy to do.
Yeah.
It was a bit complicated, like with all the matrix manipulation. So I had to, again, expand Cocos because it didn't have many of the things I needed.
Yeah.
So I needed, because they don't have affine transform or anything else like that built in. Yeah. So they just have like scale and anchor point, which
that's kind of a bummer. Yeah, if you want, yeah.
It doesn't work. So I implemented a custom version which supports basic matrices.
Do you like Cocos 2D?
it's a hard question.
Yeah, I know.
I did contribute some of the things to it, okay. But there are some mistakes in it. Like the fact that this scene management and rendering is connected together makes it very hard for stuff like batching.
Mm.
So if you look at it, if you want to batch drawings, for example, if you want to draw the same image 1,000 times, which would be very simple, like you did a game. So it would be very simple with OpenGL or DirectX in general. But because the way it's Cocos works, you have to have 1,000 sprite, whatever the name is, added to the same route.
Yeah.
So if you want to have a different connections in different part of the scene, it's going to be a problem to batch it like that.
So, yeah, it's thinking very literally in that if something is on the screen, then it is an element in the scene, right?
Yeah.
So rather than being like, you know, rather than just handing a bitmap and being able to batch it and like render 1,000 of them super easy, you need to have all of this overhead management stuff to be in the scene hierarchy.
Yeah. So what I had in my custom game engine was basically I still had the tree for the scene, which you used for control, like moving the object, the parents to move the children. So it was quite easy to control the objects, but the actual rendering was a separate thing. So when you iterated over the whole tree, you just grabbed elements to render and then automatically it batched similar stuff, which was more efficient. It's just more efficient. But Cocos in general is very good. Like the community, again, it's very good. Like I think Cocoa and Cocos have very nice communities and a lot of people contribute.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of open source stuff. And I think it's a good way to start games on iOS.
Yeah.
It's just, it might be a problem to do some more advanced stuff with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I used to, like early days of the App Store, I basically wrote effectively what's Cocos 2D for a couple of games. these days I'm just like, no, just go use Cocoa Studio. It's fine. It'll work great. You don't need my help for this, you know? It's like anything, there's some edge cases and weirdness. Sure. But, you know, in general, I think it's a...
Yeah, in general, it's great. It's just great because the community is so huge, so you can ask questions and people will answer very quickly.
Yeah.
And people will help you, so they are, like, really decent folks on the Cocos forums. So it's very good. It's very good for that. And obviously, for most games, it will work very well. But be prepared to do your custom thing. So if you're afraid, like if some people are afraid of getting dirty and using OpenGL directly, I have bad advice because it's never going to work. Right. You will have to go to use OpenGL directly at some points. Just get over it.
Yeah, that's not as scary as... Well, maybe.
For some people, like... I have a lot of experience with graphics, right?
Right, yeah.
And whenever I see people, let's just use OpenGL, like people actually say that for a commercial product. Let's just use OpenGL for that. And I was like, no, don't do that.
No, well...
That's expensive. That's very expensive.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, right. Don't use it lightly, but I don't think it's... I don't think... It seems to me that people are more scared of it than they should be.
From my experience, you should be scared of it.
Like, I love that you're okay with using C++, being like, oh my God, I don't want to touch OpenGL.
No, it's not that. Come on,
I'm kidding.
Yeah, computer graphics for years, but it just feels like many people think it's so easy, but then you end up with like edge cases and all of the other stuff.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem I have with commercial work and using OpenGL, it's... Usually what happens is you have one, maybe two guys in the whole team that know OpenGL.
Yeah, this is a good point. Very good point.
And what happens for the company, if they go the OpenGL path and then that people leave, you have to find someone that knows it because all other people will just be afraid and it will be very costly. That's what I meant. Like it's quite expensive.
Yeah, okay. I see what you mean. I guess, yeah, so we're coming at it from different points of view. If you can possibly not use OpenGL, do so. Don't use it. I guess what I was trying to say was it's not as complicated as people make it seem. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not. It's not really. It's not.
You can wrap your head around it. It's not. Yeah. You're right. From an organizational point of view, avoid it if you can. I mean, avoid anything that isn't... That can't be addressed by a generalist.
High level,
exactly. Just always go to high level. That's the way you should write stuff. Yeah. Until you can't, sure. And then be very, very careful about how you address those things. But in general, I think people get more scared about graphics or lower level graphics programming than they need to be. Do you have the same feeling?
I don't think it's complicated. Like in general, it's not that hard. It's just the only problem is you already have to know a bit of math. And what happens, even for me...
I don't even know if you need to know the math. You just need to know what it does, you know?
Yeah.
Like a matrix, whatever. It doesn't matter how you multiply them together. Just what happens is what you care about, right?
Yeah, but what happens then is you recompile the project 20 times just to get something right. And it's just a painful process if people don't understand how it works correctly. Right.
Yeah.
What I find, like, even after so many years doing 3D graphics and stuff, whenever I get back to doing heavy 3D, I have to go over the algebra stuff again because I forget some of the basics even. Well, maybe not the basics, but it's not that easy to remember all of the equations and stuff.
Right.
So I usually start with like reading the book or something again before going to a heavy graphics session. Just sounds it's kind of like the math part is scary because if you really want to work on something more advanced, like it's not just using a high level engine but working directly with vectors and algorithms, then you need proper knowledge about algebra.
Yeah, I guess so.
But like,
still fun.
It's amazing fun. Like you can do stuff that you cannot do with UIKit. Even though I really enjoy UIKit, I think it's very good.
They did a great job there. And as a graphics guy, I'm sure you can appreciate how closely it sort of works with the hardware, right?
Yeah, it is. It is a very nice job. I really like it. And I think that's why, like, I always advocate to use UIKit whenever possible and Core Graphics if not possible.
Yeah.
But what happens is, I think the biggest problem with why people think graphics is hard is because people switch too easily to it without really looking to different options. And they, what happens is you end up with tons of examples of how to do things badly.
That's interesting.
Other people that learn, they look at that code and that code is just a mess and just doesn't work correctly.
Yeah.
The graphics itself, like OpenGL, DirectX, doesn't really matter. It's quite easy. It's quite easy to do. Like, even the stuff I did was like really good quality graphics.
Mm-hmm.
It still was pretty simple.
Wait, did you mean the stuff that you did in Foldify?
The Foldify was very simple. People still know how it works, but it was very simple. You probably know how it works. But
yeah, what I loved about it was like it was one of those things that made me jealous. I'm like, ah, crap, I could have done that. That's awesome. What a great idea, you know? And it's why I loved it so much. I was like, this is just perfect. Okay, what I liked is that you didn't conflate the painting and the 3D view. Because you could have been painting on the 3D model, but that would have been a bad interaction choice.
Yeah, it was. It would be a bit hard for people, especially like
because you can rotate it around, and then it'd be weird angles, and then like you just did the simple thing, and it's great. I love it. It's so. It, I don't know. I'm a fan. It worked well. Yeah.
It also lets you imagine how 2D. It's mapped to 3D, and actually people are using this for education. So like a few days ago, we had like 200 educational buys for Foldify. So I guess some school just bought it, which is pretty nice. A lot of people are using Foldify in education for kids and even stuff like...
I hadn't even thought of that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's getting more and more used in schools. We even have like... for kids with autism, people are using Foldify to help them, which is very cool.
That's great. Oh, yeah. That must make you feel so great.
Yeah. We're really happy. Like, whenever people send us some photos with small kids using Foldify and enjoying it, it's very nice.
Yeah, that's fulfilling for sure.
Yeah. For us, it's like the money it made, whatever, doesn't really... To be honest, I don't think I spent a dollar from whatever we made. I just put it on savings account. it's more about like actually getting people enjoying it and tons of people using it. We have six figures of users, so it's a lot of users, and everyone paid for it. So it did make quite a lot of money for us, but that's not really the point.
Me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not really like I was speaking with my designer today about the iPhone version. And I mean, I definitely want to do iPhone version, but I already innovated on Foldify. It's not that challenging for me. So it's,
Yeah, like you're not chasing the product anymore. It's like, the idea is out there. So doing an iPhone version is like, not exciting. Yeah,
exactly.
It's nice. Do you have any other good ideas that I can steal, like right now?
I have tons of ideas. That's the thing. Sure. Like I have actual on Evernote. I have a folder with ideas, which is like 20 game ideas or app ideas already. Great. And I need to do prototypes for that. It's like,
That's always hard, eh? I start so many like little code projects that just never go anywhere just because I'm interested in
Well, I have this. I always create whenever I go, even for work.
Uh-huh.
I always have this iOS playground, which is like a Git repository for all the small ideas.
Uh-huh.
And for example, like 2 years ago, I created an algorithm for physics, which is atom based. So basically. It's all point, I don't remember the exact name, it's point-based physics. So basically, each atom is a separate point, and the points interact with each other, which means you can basically break everything to a smaller possible piece, like actual Atom. Kind of scary, but it looks so good. It looks so good.
There's a fun game in there somewhere, I can tell.
Well, yeah. Think about it. Distraction, not at the level of like just divide a box into four pieces. Distraction, right. The level, destroy everything until there is nothing left.
Yeah. I did this that. One game I worked on was, the whole engine and everything. It was sort of grid-based, and you could destroy blocks on the bottom, and then, like, you could destroy anything at the level, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was all physics-based, so if something was holding something else up, like, everything would fall. That was a lot of work to get that working. Also, turns out pathfinding in an environment that can be destroyed is a pain in the ass. Because at any one point, something can just totally get wiped out. And you need your guys to be, pathing all the time.
Yeah,
Like doing the right
dynamically
thing.
Dynamically, yeah.
Yeah. So it got confusing real quick.
Yeah, I mean, I really like physics for games. I really like it. I think it's like having a nice graphics and a very good physics. And you, from that point, you already have something that's better than most of the games.
I think so. Even if you don't have a reward system per se, you've got something that you can play with, like literally play with,
Yeah. Physics is really good. Like, I think physics, especially for 2D, it's more important than even for like with 3D. Yeah, it's cool with physics and all, but it's not that interactive. Like in 2D, you can just make everything be crazy, like go crazy and still have fun with it.
Yeah.
Which is very nice. So actually, like, for example, 2 years ago, I think, I just had a thing for physics back then. And I also wrote for Box2D, which is like the most common 2D physics engine. Yeah. So I actually wrote a cutting algorithm, which allows you to cut everything on the whole Box2D world. You can cut everything. And you can have items connected with springs and all the other stuff. And you can cut that as well. Nice. It just looks so cool. And it's like just a few hundred lines of code to add this. And you can have a bridge. You can cut the bridge in half. Well, you can cut it any way you want because it allows you to basically slice items as you see fit. No limits, no...
That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, no boxing or anything. So it's perfect cutting the way you want. It's pretty nice. I need to use that in a game.
Yeah, that seems like it could be a game by itself for some reason.
Yeah. The thing is, like, I think for iOS, what matters the most, you have to have really good graphics or you're just not going to be visible on the market. Yeah. It's like if people see bad screenshots, for example, if you don't have a graphics artist working with you, it's going to be very hard to get noticed. On the other hand, there are some games that don't have really good graphics, and they are still huge.
What's good? Like, what's that one from the Half Brick guys that just came out? Out of Water, where you throw fish. That's not great graphics, but it's effective and it's good and it's got character. You know what I mean? Like like Fruit Ninja. Those aren't great graphics.
Mm-hmm.
But they're good. But they're good graphics.
It's gonna be hard to be noticed if you have programmer doing
right. Rightfully so. I mean, you shouldn't.
Yeah. On the other hand, Tiny Wings was made by one guy, right?
Yeah, but that's got such a great feel to it.
Yeah, it's a great game. It's very simple as well, but it's
what you're saying, like nice graphics and physics.
Yeah, that's the thing. Physics just
right.
Yeah. Which is your favorite game, like from the last few years? Favorite iOS game?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm weird with games. Like, I check them out almost clinically. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. The console I have at home is a Wii, and I basically never play it. Mm-hmm. And because I did games professionally for a long time, and then I just sort of checked out. Like, I couldn't sit down and enjoy them because I'd just be analyzing it the whole time.
Yeah.
That said, maybe Jetpack Joyride. I've played a lot. It's kind of mindless, but I just like the music and I like the feel of it. I played Cannonbolt a lot. Just again, because it's just super simple. And I like Adam, so. I don't know. Do you have one?
For me, The Room. It's probably the best. Game I have ever seen, and like I don't really like 3D games on mobile, but this is just perfect. It's like so clever, so good.
Okay, check that out. Post haste. Anything else?
It's a hard question.
Yeah. Well, you asked me, so.
sure. I'm thinking. I don't really play a lot on iOS, to be honest.
Do you play consoles a lot?
Yeah. I play on PS3 a lot.
Yeah.
I am playing Tomb Raider now.
Cool. Is it good?
It's very good.
Very good.
It feels a bit like Uncharted.
Yeah.
But even a bit Uncharted better
just,
at some points.
Yeah. I don't want to be unfair, but I mean, they're basically just all Indiana Jones games.
Yeah, I really like Indiana Jones.
So. Yeah.
It's like the definition of adventure, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, totally.
So, yeah, from PS3, Dishonored, probably one of my favorite.
Yeah.
You play?
I'm waiting for the next consoles to come out so I'll buy one. I'll get back into it. It's been like 10 years since I haven't really paid any attention. Well,
really?
Yeah. I'd had enough, man. Like, yeah, when you work in there, it's, you know, you want to check out.
Yeah, I really enjoy like adventure games, and I think the thing I am missing is the old games like Monkey's the Secrets of Monkey's Land and stuff like that.
Like the what? Monkey
Island. Yeah. That was the game. Like, this is so cool. The old stuff. I heard the people were the. Did you guys play Flashback?
Yes, game? Man, I love that game.
You know, they're actually working on a how it's called?
Sequel?
Not sequel. Basically, they redo it, the whole game.
A reboot?
Reboot. So nice. They did it with 3D, but it looks like it still has all the things it should have.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really looking very nice. I can send you over a link.
Yeah, do that. That's awesome. I'm
looking forward to it because that was one of my favorite games back in the day.
This is going to sound weird, but so my friend Gosia is Polish, and she grew up in Poland for years. And my favorite story, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with this, is at one point, like during the 80s, they would have radio stations that would broadcast software, and you could record it to tape, and then you could use that in your like Commodore 64 kind of thing.
I didn't know that.
That is the most awesome thing I've ever heard. The fact, like, literally software piracy over the radio. That's like, I just want to high five everybody that thought of that. It's so great. Please, nobody steal my software. but the idea is just so awesome.
Yeah, it sounds very nice. Like, so ahead of the time, right?
Yeah, it's just crazy. It's like a mix of old tech and high tech, and you know, it's just great. I love it. It's very, it's an interesting way to use technology. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm always impressed by people coming up with ideas that sounds very easy, like after you already hear it, and then like no one ever thought about it before. It's just, this is what happens, right? This is what happens. The same thing with Foldify, it isn't that complicated. And people were like, why didn't I think about it before? Like,
that's why I loved it so much. I, yeah. I, yeah, it's such a great piece of software.
to be honest, I had no idea if it's going to be a hit or miss until I released the video. Uh-huh. Like when we put the video on and a PR to people approached us and mm-hmm. it was scary. Like I saw, like I was constantly refreshing Twitter and looking at the Foldify hashtag. Mm. I was like, and then we had people like, for example, Daring Fireball, right, wrote about yeah. it. Just single line, this is why we have printers or something like that. It was like 80,000 people hit the website. Yeah. It was scary. Yeah. It was really scary. Was,
I wonder if Epson or HP are going to send you a check for all those printers you sold.
Probably should.
Yeah, we are looking into some cooperation with some companies right now with Foldify. So there is still a lot of things we want to try innovate on and mm-hmm. make it easier for the users. But yeah, let's see what happens. So most of the stuff is still private, so I can't really speak about it. But there is quite a few interesting things that should happen soon. I also want to expand the current version to offer a preview in browser. So instead of sharing a photo of your 3D figure, you're going to share a link which has HTML5 in it. Mm-hmm. And you can rotate around the whole thing, which is, I think, is cool. It's just very
that
cool.
That is cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're not going to use WebGL. You're going to do it with the HTML5, right?
Yeah, I'm probably going to look into libraries. Right now I looked into 3JS, which mm-hmm. is like the go-to library for easy graphics on the web, which mm-hmm. like, yeah, I'm still looking if I should write it myself or just ask someone, because I'm not a web dev guy.
Yeah.
But it seems hard.
Yeah. Yeah. You any good with web stuff at all? Like I'm not, which is why I'm asking. And I think I say this on every single show. So.
I'm learning Ruby, but mostly I used it in Foldify for scripting stuff.
Right.
So I really like the language. It's very nice. And
why'd you pick Ruby rather than Lua?
Lua, really?
It seems like the go-to thing for game people.
Yeah, but it's for scripting inside games instead of scripting tools and stuff.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, I use Lua with my game engine, the one I showed you before. Yeah. So I use that in game. But like a few days ago, I released a tool called Crafter, which is a gem, a Ruby gem you can install. And then you basically can set up your iOS or Cocoa project once, so we specify like a configuration file, which is this Ruby syntax. So we specify like, these are my favorite pods, these are the settings I want, the warnings, and all the other stuff. And then you just call Crafter on your folder where you have the Xcode project, and it's gonna set it up for you.
Cool.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Take a look.
I'll check it out.
So yeah, I like Ruby because it's very easy to do stuff like that. So it's very simple language. Well, it's not simple language, but it's very powerful, yet it's easy to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to learn it. The next
language makes sense. It's Python? I used Python as a game scripting language years ago. It's pretty good, but I forget most of it. So
Well, it's nice, like, you have to be pragmatic, right? So, I mean, Objective-C, I really like Objective-C, but it's just not the best tool for stuff like that. So, for example, with Foldify, we have a lot of stamps, which are the elements you can drag in and use ready, like the ready elements. So each of the element has an icon, and then it has a proper image. So we had, at some point, I was loading all of the images and I needed to have the size of the original thing. So at start, the naive approach would be to load everything and then remove it, which is like wasting resources and performance and just doesn't work correctly. So what I needed is an XML description that would have all the proper sizes. So I could just read the XML right. description instead of doing that real time. So I wrote a Ruby script, which was like, I don't know, 20 lines of code.
Yeah, just to tear through everything and like
fix everything. It's so good. So nice.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Being pragmatic is important. You know, pragmatic rather than dogmatic is it.
I mean, I sometimes break model view controller. Like people go overboard with all the paradigms and design rules. Like you have to use your own judgment for that. Obviously, exactly. For me, when I write code, the biggest thing I always care about is the code should be dry. So I shouldn't be repeating myself multiple times. And right. then it's about keeping it simple. So I like having flexible code, but I don't do it. Like I try to avoid doing flexibility by abstraction. So it's like creating right. tons of abstract classes and stuff like that. Instead, I'd rather do simplicity. Like I use simplicity to make it flexible. So for example, I sometimes use factoring and dynamic method resolution and stuff like mm-hmm. that, which makes it very simple. Like for example...
This is why C++ doesn't make you want to kill yourself, by the way. Because, the tendency with a lot of, honestly, probably inexperienced C++ developers is to just make the most complicated... crazy hierarchy and abstraction system possible.
Yeah. That's crazy. All right. I agree. Like composition is very useful to avoid stuff like that. So people do too much inheritance instead of doing composition properly.
Right.
That simplifies things. Yeah. But what I find is like people go with like high level abstraction, creating a bunch of classes that don't do anything just to have this flexible code, and they never use that code. Yeah. So that's what usually happens. I even had a blog post about it some time ago. Yeah. Basically people are writing classes and they just try to do it so universal that they can use it in other projects, but they never do. Like most people never do.
Right.
So it's better. Like this is what I had because I worked with many guys that had similar experience as I did. Like when I started, so a game dev experience. Mm-hmm. And when we did games, right, when we did engines and stuff, we did everything from scratch because we wanted to learn. So that was the way to go. It's a great way to go and learn new stuff. Just do it from scratch. Don't count on anything else. And it's a very bad way to go if you are working on a commercial product, in my opinion, because
people learn a lot.
Yeah.
There's a certain value to that, but you don't make a good piece of software necessarily.
Yeah, do you want to learn on a project that your company is paying for?
Right.
You want to learn by doing it properly.
Right.
But what happened, what I noticed, is people were writing their own components instead of using the ones that are already there and they're already tested and they're already like validated by the different scenarios and stuff. So this, you have to be careful when you start working on a commercial product. It's when you come back, like when you go from being indie and doing it for yourself and learning, when you move to actual commercial work, you have to be careful. Like, what do you choose? Because it's more about the success of the project and the success of the company than it is about learning
right.
a specific bit. Like you still learn a lot. Like it's a bit different, right? Commercial work is different. But yeah, I mean, what I find is I avoid writing my own stuff if I already have something tested.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's a sensible way to go.
Yeah. I still love to write custom stuff.
Yeah, but that's the temptation that you sort of grow out of, I guess, is the best way of putting it, right? Like, you have to grow out of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What's your Twitter handle?
Mirroring_.
Mirroring_. Why the underscore?
Because Mirroring was already taken.
Huh.
That was the only way to go.
Makes sense.
Try writing Krzysztof Zabłocki.
And then
writing it from podcast. Good luck.
And if that was taken, you wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite easy. Like, I use the same handle for Skype. So
yeah, I noticed that.
And what's your blog?
Merrowing.info.